The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
The 2025 Missouri legislative session brings new bills, new leadership, and a bunch of new faces to the Missouri Capitol. The freshman class in the House alone has over 50 new members. On this episode of Politically Speaking, one of those new representatives, Wick Thomas, joins the show. Thomas, a Kansas City Democrat, is the first transgender and non-binary person to be elected to the Missouri legislature. In addition to discussing their expectations for session, Thomas, a librarian, also spoke on the importance of supporting the state's libraries. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
Let's go back to some of those policies, to that peace and prosperity that we had some 4 to 5 years ago.
Everywhere is Democratic country once this Democrat's been there.
There are a lot of things in Washington that are very bipartisan, including some bills that I've already gotten passed.
And I think it works best when you can see both sides, but you have to pick one, and I firmly align with the Republicans.
But certainly, I think if she's running against one of the crazy dudes, certainly it's going to be a lot easier.
But I'll take wisdom and age and a few missteps in Oralto over somebody who has no substance.
I believe that you represent the party's values and you move forward, and that's what I have done.
Welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, State House and politics reporter Sarah Kellogg. Joining me in St. Louis, he is St. Louis Public Radio's political correspondent,
Jason Rosenbaum.
And joining me in the Jefferson City studio, they are the Missouri House representative for the 19th District, which represents part of Kansas City,
Wick Thomas.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show. We're so excited. We always love having first-time guests. And to start off, we kind of do the same thing, which is just tell us a little bit about yourself and what kind of led you to being a representative.
Yeah, so my name is Wick Thomas. I currently live in Kansas City. I represent District 19, which is West Side, West Bottoms, River Market, Columbus Park, Northeast, and down across the 435 corridor down south. This is the place I love. It's the place I fell in love with so many things. I originally grew up in Drexel, Missouri, a town of about 900, about an hour south of Kansas City. I have had a long history of activism. I got kicked out at 17, was homeless briefly as a teenager in rural Missouri and Kansas. I graduated from Paola, Kansas, and while we were there, started at GSA, did a lot of work there, activist work that kind of set me off into the path that I found throughout my life. Got some awards for my activist work that I did there. As soon as I was of age, I moved to Kansas City. Since then, I love Kansas City so much. I got this part-time job at the library in Westside, the Reeves Library, and it was there that I fell in love with libraries. If you had told me that when I was 18, I probably would have I wouldn't have believed you. I was not a reader until I was like 19 years old. I read a book that totally changed my life. I had that like aha moment, and fell in love with that job and with Westside and with libraries, and decided I wanted to be a librarian. And so most of my career has been in libraries and museums. I worked for the Kansas City Public Library for about 10 years. I was the manager of teen programs for the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. And most recently, I was at Metropolitan Community Colleges, the Penn Valley campus, as a faculty librarian there. I had to resign, obviously, a few weeks ago because I am now state representative for District 19.
What was that book, if you don't mind my asking?
That is The Once and Future King by T.H. White. It was a book that I was not a reader, but I was at Barnes & Noble or, you know, some bookstore like that. And there was a family there, and a woman picked up this book in the bargain bin, and it was The Once and Future King. And she picked it up, and she was like, oh, that's a really good price for that book. And me, She put it back down, though, and me wanting to seem intelligent as a, you know, 19-year-old picked it up and was like, what's so good about it, you know? And it was just the first time I'd really fallen in love with literature. I hadn't really read outside of what was required of me, you know, for school or for different things. And so it just changed my life, changed the path of my life reading that book.
So this was your third time running for this seat, and it was perhaps your best chance since you were not taking on incumbent State Representative Ingrid Burnett. Why did you think you pulled off your victory in the August Democratic primary, which was really the real contest in a heavily Democratic district?
Yeah, I think my community work, I have dedicated my life to Kansas City and to community activism and support. The redistricting in 2022 added in West Side, the River Market, and the West Bottoms, and so these are the areas of Kansas City that I love and that are have been such an important part of my life. Again, the Rees Library in West Side, they have an amazing seed library. Go check it out. You can check out plants. That's where I got my first library job at 19. And it was, you know, a technical assistant position. It wasn't, I had no intention of being a librarian at that time. But West Side is where I loved. I've worked there for 20 years now, and they made me fall in love with libraries. I got married in the West Bottoms a couple years ago. The Northeast is my home. I live in Sierra Renaissance, and it's the most amazing place I've ever lived. My grandma actually was a Northeast Viking, class of 1933. I didn't know that until I moved there, though. She had actually grown up. I did a bunch of genealogical research, and she had actually grown up about three blocks from where I had purchased my house there about a decade ago. And so there are every single area of that district I love, and I am incredibly active in the community. I do weekly parks cleanups. We did story times. We did just youth voter registration rock concerts. We were trying to be really unique, and these campaigns cost a lot of money. And so we wanted to try and run them differently. We wanted to run it as a community benefit. That way, even if we didn't win, we'd feel really good about what we had done. And so we handed out native seeds while we were door knocking door to door, Coreopsis and some marigold seeds. And we did everything for the community. We wanted to show that politics can be done different and better. And I think it resonated. I think there is a lot of dissatisfaction with like the political machine as it currently is. And I think that this was us trying to do something differently, and it worked.
With your election, you are the first transgender and non-binary legislator in Missouri history. And this comes at a time when Republicans in particular have made curtailing rights for transgender children and adults a major focal point of their political and policy agenda. So how do you feel about entering legislative service in Missouri during this point in time?
Yeah, I feel like this is exactly where I'm supposed to be at right now. I care deeply about this issue. I care deeply about these kids. And it feels very similar to the bullying I experienced in high school. It's just now on a legislative level. I see it as a way to cover up, because trans people are such a small percentage of the population, right? It's a way to cover up the lack of effective work, the lack of effective legislation in the Missouri government. I think as long as they're getting these sensational headlines, they're not having to do their jobs, or they're not having to be beholden to their constituents because they have these sensational topics. And unfortunately, you know, they're playing with people's lives. When I was younger, I said earlier, I think I started a Gay Straight Alliance, is what we called them at the time, but it was just like basically trying to be a meetup group for students who weren't sure, you know, who felt maybe they were different. And because of that, we had a student who created a rap CD about how he was going to kill us, he produced it, you know, in his basement and made copies and distributed it throughout the high school. And one of my friends, you know, got a copy of it and gave it to me, and I took it to the administration, and they didn't care, you know. And then I took it to the police, and they didn't care either. They said it was a freedom of speech issue that the student had distributed a song about how he was going to kill us and named people specifically in that song even. And so I escalated, and I found out that Promo was doing a lobbying day, and I came to Jefferson City and I talked to any representative or senator that I could find. And I was like 17 at the time. You know, I had no idea how any of this worked. And I found out no one here cared either. And that was a really eye-opening experience for me, I think, to have so little support, and not just little support, but adults that were actively trying to harm me or knowing that I was being harmed and did not care. And I think that I wouldn't have, even recently, before 5 years ago, I would not have said I was going to run for state representative. But it feels full circle that I'm here in this building during this time period.
I have been following what's been happening nationally because the first transgender congresswoman, Sarah McBride of Delaware, was just sworn in a couple days ago as of this recording. And I've noticed there have been some GOP legislators just belittling and misgendering McBride nonstop and have been kind of emphasizing the misgendering, maybe to get attention. Is there any concern that you may face a similar reception with some of your GOP colleagues, or have you like tried to talk with some of them maybe in like the freshman tour, and they, I guess, may understand where you're coming from since they are now talking with you face to face, basically?
Yeah, and the freshman tour, if anyone doesn't know, that's the 2-week bus trip that all the freshman legislators get to go on, and it was a great experience, also exhausting, as you can imagine. But I made a lot of good friends on both sides of the aisle on that tour. And my hope is that they see me as a person, and that, you know, even if we disagree politically, like, they will hear me, and they will try to understand my perspective. That is my hope. That said, I think, again, a lot of this is just smoke and mirrors. You know, it is to avoid the actual issues. It is to demonize a group of people. And we've seen this throughout history, right? Like, it comes and goes, different groups. But, like, there's always a group that someone's trying to attack to avoid the responsibility that we have to our constituents of doing effective legislation, of effectively representing them. And I think this is just the current thing. It mirrors exactly what was happening to the gay community in the 80s. And trans people are not a new thing, too. We've been around forever in every culture, every continent. Unfortunately, we just don't teach those histories. But that's why I'm so happy I became a librarian. I can find those histories, and they're there. They're easy to find. I think that's why the anti-library laws go hand in hand with the anti-trans laws, because we don't, you know, it's that's where you find out that we've always existed. So I hope I have faith that some of my colleagues in the GOP will care about this issue, because the ones who, and yes, of course, I've already heard things. The thing is, it's the exact same stuff I was hearing at 16, you know, when I came out. So this is nothing new for me. I was getting death threats at 16, so. I've to be bullied now in the Missouri legislature isn't a problem for me. I've been dealing with this my whole life, and so they can say whatever they want. That how other people treat me does not affect how I am going to treat them. I'm going to go into this with an open mind and an open heart, and attempt a spirit of joy. One of my favorite Gandhi quotes is his autobiography, also life-changing book. But service rendered without a spirit of joy helps neither the servant nor the served. And that's something that I try to keep in the forefront of my mind.
Well, let's talk about another aspect of your biography that I'm very interested in. And that is the fact that you are a librarian. For full disclosure, my wife, Lauren, is a librarian at Washington University. So I happen to hear about the politics of libraries probably more than the average journalist. You have probably been watching what has been going on in Missouri politics with trying to, quote unquote, keep indecent material away from kids. What has been kind of your perception of that? And what do you hope to bring to what could be a debate over the next few years as an actual librarian?
That is a really good question. I think that is a big piece of why I wanted to run. I see libraries as the last stand of democracy. Once we start attacking libraries, we have started the death knell of a democracy. If you read any of the documents by the Founding Fathers, if you read anything throughout history, really, like, the importance of libraries is paramount to an effective democracy. The importance of perspectives, the importance of different ideas. The whole point of this, right, the whole point of government is to be able to debate these issues in an intelligent and reasonable fashion. And that's where you find out these histories, right, is at the library. So I think if you want to push a singular narrative, if you want what you're saying to be the only thing that is considered, then you destroy the libraries, which destroys democracy in the long term. And so I think that that is a piece of it. I think that there is a power structure that that benefits from libraries being attacked. It's ridiculous, right? Because like we don't need to give any further reason for educators to not want to move to Missouri. Currently, we're still 50th in teacher pay. Now that we are trying to criminalize librarians, which I don't know if you've met children's librarians. They are like the sweetest people. As an academic librarian, but children's librarians, they just want to help kids. Like that is their whole job. So the fact that we are trying to criminalize them and demonize them is just horrifying to me, and makes it is not the Missouri that I've grown up in. Again, I'm a lifelong Missourian. It is not the Missouri that I want to see, and it is. I will fight so hard to stop it from becoming the Missouri of the future.
I'm curious, from a funding perspective, how dependent are publicly funded libraries on state government?
Yeah, definitely. It depends on the library, really. So the city libraries, right, have other sources of funding. I mean, libraries always need more funding, right? There's always new things to purchase. And again, libraries have kept up with the times. I don't know if you've been to your local library, but they're amazing. So go check it out. but they provide computer access. So many people don't have internet access, and so they provide that. They the IT costs alone are huge. So the cities have more revenue streams, you know, than the rural public libraries. And so what these laws are mostly hurting, right? Because I know at my library growing up in Drexel, they had one staff person, one librarian who did everything, like all things, maintenance, you know, checking out books, ordering, like literally everything. That one librarian did that. And so the idea that all these new regulations that they have to comply with to receive state funding is going to shut them down. They are at capacity. They are doing so much for the community already. They are serving their communities as the government should, right? And they are going to be demonized. They are going to lose their funding because they do not have the capacity to follow all these new regulations that they're trying to pass.
Do you think that the state should provide more money to libraries, or is there concern that being dependent on the state would mean that there would be strings attached, which could worsen local autonomy?
I think more funding for libraries needs to come from every source. I truly believe that libraries are the great equalizer. They changed my life. I am from rural Missouri poverty. I am, just as of yesterday, a state representative, you know, for Jackson County, and I wouldn't be that if it weren't for libraries. They are so incredibly important to our communities because they make it so people who are from poverty, who are from rural areas, have access to knowledge. And I feel like because we have phones, you know, that we think everyone has the internet and that everything's on the internet, and it's just not true. And anyone who says that, I feel like, has not visited their library recently or has not really done much intensive research, because they're just so incredibly important.
Moving on to the beginning of the 2025 session, as we're taping this, that happened yesterday. It'll be the first session that Governor-elect Mike Kehoe will be in charge of the state government. What are your general expectations for this session?
Civility and working for the people of Missouri. Those are my expectations.
Elaborate a little on that for me.
If I must. That is my expectation, right? This is the government. We are serving the people. That is how I am trying to walk into this. I know a lot of people already know who I am and have already attempted to demonize me. I'm not going to let that affect me representing the people of District 19, because they trusted me to do this job, and that is not my job. My job is not politics. It is not that piece of it. It is not playing those games. My job is to represent them well. And to do that, I am trying, again, to come into this with a open mind and open heart. And I expect other people to do the same. Whether they do that or not is up to them.
This session started with a little bit of GOP intra-party warfare when Representative Justin Sparks failed in his bid to oust Speaker John Patterson. You know, Democrats actually joined in voting for Patterson, not just voting president, but voting for Patterson. Why do you think House Democrats decided to make this move?
Yeah, I think with Ashley Aune, Democratic leader, declining the nomination that she was given to be the speaker, it became the logical choice. I think it's as simple as that. There's a lot more faith on both sides of the aisle that Patterson will try to be a representative House chair than there was the alternative.
That being said, you know, Minority Leader Aune doesn't expect House Republicans to be super collaborative with Democrats, pointing out that Patterson needed to win support from more conservative members from the GOP caucus to become speaker at all. Do you share that trepidation?
I think I have the novelty of coming into this new and that where I am holding my expectations of people in high standard, where they will try to be collaborative. They will try to represent the entire state well and realize that the needs of the cities are different than the needs of the rural areas, and that they should receive weight. You know, they should be weighted in that way. I am probably fairly unique in this that I'm from rural areas. I grew up my whole childhood in rural areas, and I now live in a city. And so I think I maybe understand both sides of this more than some. But I think I have faith in that. I'm going to go into it until I have reason to believe otherwise.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
And we're back on Politically Speaking. Our guest on this episode is Representative Wick Thomas. They are the representative for the 19th District, which represents part of Kansas City. So we're going to get back into more issues. Are there kind of policies or issues that you expect Republicans and Democrats to collaborate on this year? And if so, what do you think those issues are?
I hope so. I mean, I hope we can in good faith work on all of these issues together. That would be the goal for, I think, Missourians, for the people of Missouri. That said, I think it's yet to be seen. I think that there are allies for a lot of different topics on both sides of the aisle. And I know I am coming into this completely willing and ready and excited even to work with my Republican colleagues to find common ground and mutual respect and mutual things that our constituents need.
One of the issues that will likely become a major point of contention is whether to place a gubernatorial board in charge of the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department. And that's a similar setup to what's in place in Kansas City. Kansas City's local elected leaders do not directly control the police department. The mayor is on the board, but he is outnumbered by four gubernatorial appointees. So I'm curious, like, how do your constituents view this setup that has been in place for many decades now?
Yeah, I think that the setup is not working for the majority of my constituents. From the people that I've heard from, this just isn't an effective system of governance for it. And I feel like I've heard that from our elected officials. I've heard that from my neighbors. I've heard that from so many people. I live in a district where in a lot of the parts of the district, we hear gunshots almost every night. I know I called some in several months ago that the response time, it was right outside my house and I was on hold, I think, for 8 minutes. And then it took another, you know, it was 20 minutes before anyone was able to even come to check it out. And that's obviously unacceptable. So there are so many things that I think can be approved. And I think I am always generally in favor of local control of such things. I think the people in Kansas City know best. I think that's what my constituents want too. And so that's something that I'm going to work toward, is actually trying to remove that system. I don't think it's working well for the people in my district.
This is going to be a wonky question, but I like a wonky municipal question. So Kansas City's mayor, I don't want to say that they're like a glorified at-large councilman, because I do think the mayor has some power, but they really don't run the day-to-day operations of city government. That's done by the city manager. If Kansas City were to get, like, if you got rid of this board, who would run the police department? Would it be the mayor's office? Would it be the city manager? Would it be like the city council runs it from the council? Like, has that part been discussed among people who don't like state control at all?
I mean, I think we look to the other cities of similar size for models, look to the cities where the response times and the crime rates are the best and lowest, and we use those models. I'm not aware either way, whether those discussions have been happening about that replacement, but that is something I will follow up on, actually, and I'll get back to you.
There are some proponents of so-called state control that say if you have a state board overseeing a local police department, it could insulate it, the police department, from local political pressures. Like, what do you make of that contention?
I respect that argument. I think that we can talk through this, but I think that these regions are so different is a big piece of it for me. St. Louis is a very different city than Kansas City, and the needs are different. And so I think that having local control, especially when it comes to crime rates, when it comes to response times, is something that you can hold officials accountable for. I think that tends to be a more effective system is if the policies that people are putting in place actually affect them and their communities, because then they have to hear from their communities. And I don't know if that's happening right now on a large scale with the current setup.
Let's move on to the topic of abortion, which I feel like will be very forefront this session. And on Wednesday, Senate President Pro Tem Cindy O'Loughlin signaled that the fight over abortion rights in Missouri over the wake of Amendment 3 is not over, and that the GOP majority would try to put something else either before voters to either repeal or replace Amendment 3. First of all, what do you make of these types of efforts?
I think the people of Missouri have spoken. They voted. They decided. And so I think this is those efforts are an affront to the will of the people and the tenets of our democracy.
Speaker Patterson mentioned specifically that lawmakers may try to pass legislation on the definition of fetal viability, which is currently defined as when a medical professional determines that a fetus can survive outside of the womb without extraordinary medical intervention. Patterson says that's too vague. What do you think?
I think, again, it's smoke and mirrors. I think that there are so many of these topics, right, that the people voted, the people decided, and now it's still in the news, because it will get headlines, right? It will get people talking. It will maybe for them get them reelected. I don't know. But the people decided. The people already have settled this issue for the legislature. And so it is them wasting taxpayer dollars. It is them not doing the job that we've been hired to do, because the people have already spoken on this issue.
Within the language of Amendment 3 is basically an allowance for lawmakers to legislate past the point of fetal viability. So do you think that then kind of makes sense for Patterson to want to clarify that, because that basically can prove what they as a Republican caucus could maybe do beyond a particular point, that if they define it in however way they decide to this session, possibly?
Yeah, I mean, obviously they can and they will attempt that. I think that for me, again, the people have spoken on this issue. The intense amount of time, energy, taxpayer dollars, effort that they'll put into this is not solving so many other problems. So many people I know do not have health care. They do not. They can barely afford rent. They can barely afford groceries. They are not receiving a quality education. They do not have a trade they can learn, or a skill that, you know, like or a college that they can afford, or access to these things. And luckily, there are a lot of local great union programs and community colleges. But there's so many people trying to fill these gaps that the legislature has created by focusing on these issues that are not the governance of the state. They are moralistic issues that are should not take the intense amount of time they do away from the important work of the state, which is making sure that people are okay, making sure people have access to homes and healthcare and good jobs and education. That's what I would like to spend the majority of my time on.
You know, one thing that Leader Ani mentioned is that, you know, the idea of what a solution or a replacement or, you know, for Amendment 3 for Republicans looks very different depending on the Republican you ask, that there might not be a consensus on that. And do you think that there will be an agreement that there will be an ideal replacement or, you know, change for Amendment 3 that Republicans would agree on that would make it past the finish line? What do you make of that?
Currently, I am not aware of any particular agreement on what that would look like. Ideally, right, there would be more time for debate on these kinds of things and actual compromise and actual, like, more people and perspectives coming to the table. Unfortunately, that is not the way it is currently working. And So I don't currently know whether they have something that they could all agree on, but I think that's the problem with so many moralistic issues that they're trying to legislate right now, is that there are so many differences of opinion, and that's good for democracy, that's good for America, that's good for Missouri, and so I'm not sure.
All right, in the last couple minutes we have, these two award-winning sports reporters, Sarah Kellogg and Jason Rosenbaum, are going to talk about efforts to keep the Chiefs and the Royals.
Eventually, Jason, mm-hmm. we're going to have to tell listeners what that's about. It is true, but continue.
Yeah, no, it's true. We both won an award from the Missouri Broadcasters Association for following the departure of the St. Louis Rams in 2016. So we are very familiar with this stadium debacle issue.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, like, I'm kind of scratching my head figuring out, like, what is in it for the St. Louis region to devote potentially hundreds of millions of dollars for the Chiefs and the Royals to stay here and not move to Kansas. We already went through this in St. Louis, where we devoted a lot of state money to the Dome, and the Battlehawks are playing there, and it's great, but, like, why should we give a lot of state money to keep these teams from moving 10 miles away?
I mean, you're the award winner on this topic. I think you should tell me the answer to that question.
Well, I mean, what I've heard is, like, well, we got to keep the Chiefs in Missouri because it's a source of pride and they're winning all the Super Bowls and Patrick Mahomes is great. And all this is true, but they're still going to be Kansas City's team if they're in Kansas. All it will mean will be that Kansas bankrupts itself. And as a Missourian, I'm all for that. So what do you think about that?
I mean, obviously, it's hard not to love the Chiefs right now, right? Like, they are bringing so much hometown pride and so much great stuff, and then they just keep winning, and the Royals, it's a part of living in that region is that those sports teams are like magic. That said, I think that luckily in District 19 we have the KC Current, we have the CPKC Stadium for the NWSL, and that is the stadium that I love. That I've been a season ticket holder for 4 years now, and that is I think that stadium did everything so well. I think that the funding structures, the vendors, the food vendors are local small businesses. Like, that is amazing. So everything that they've done, they've brought so much pride to that region. And the riverfront, in pretty much every major city, right, the riverfront is a destination. It hasn't been that in Kansas City. And what they've done, how well they've done it, has made it so that area is now being developed and that our riverfront is going to be a destination now. And so I think that they're the ones we look toward, right? Like, they're the ones that we look to as an example of how this could be done. Yeah, so... you know, KC baby.
I mean, that's a similar situation to St. Louis City. There are our own MLS team in St. Louis where that was mainly privately funded. It wasn't, you know, tax dollars weren't used there. I mean, you look this past April, Kansas City residents rejected a tax that would have gone towards the Royals and the Chiefs. So do you think that is definitely a more a private issue versus an issue of the public and public dollars?
Yeah, my district pretty overwhelmingly voted against that. So I think that particularly in my district, I think, well, and with that recent example of the CPK KC Stadium and how well it was done. The idea that we are on the ground. Again, I'm from poverty. I'm not wealthy. We're struggling right now. There are people being evicted. Our homeless rates are going up because of it. The idea that when we can't even access healthcare, we can't access education. You know, we can't access so many things that we need to live. We can't afford groceries that millionaires would need more money to be able to build another stadium when we already have a functional one, I think was just not a message that resonated right now in my district. And the KC tenants have been really impressive organizers in Kansas City with low-income people. And I think the demonization of them when they are so working so hard for the community was messaging that just did not land.
That is all the time we have. Thank you so much, Representative Thomas, for joining me here in Jefferson City and joining us on the show. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is a part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. You can follow all of our work, politics and not, at stlpr.org. And Representative Thomas, where can people find you on the internet where you want to be found?
Yeah, that's fair. you can find me on the House website now, house.mo.gov, WickThomas.org, WickFormo.com, any of those. We will update it any day now. We've been waiting to do a lot of that until the official House accounts were in place. So there will be a lot of updates coming.
All right. Until next time. So long.
Politically Speaking is produced by Jason Rosenbaum, Rachel Lippman, and me, Sarah Kellogg. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.